The Mexican nation, which for 300 years has not had its own will, nor the free use of its voice, rises today from the oppression in which it has lived. The Mexican nation solemnly declares through its supreme junta of the empire that it is a sovereign nation and independent from old Spain, with which, in the future, it will not maintain another union but that of a close friendship, in the terms prescribed by international treaties.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. The series has been pretty Anglo-centric so far, which means that it has focused mostly on the United States and British imperial history. Indeed, we have rarely talked about the United States and Spanish imperial history. So today we're going to fill that gap with a deep dive into the Spanish Empire and Mexican history. What was Mexico like in the 1700s? Was there already a strong, independent Mexican national identity? And what did Mexicans think about their Spanish king? Was he a tyrant like King George, or something entirely different? And what about those Protestant Anglo neighbors to the north? What did Mexicans think about the British American colonists? Looking specifically at the Declaration of Independence, how did Mexicans react to it? Did they react to it? Did the events of 1776 change the way they viewed the Spanish Empire? Of course, in the early 1800s, Latin American nations from Argentina to Colombia to Guatemala declared independence against their imperial ruler as well. And Mexico eventually declared independence from Spain in 1821. Now, and here's a big but. The way I presented this historical narrative is already potentially a problem. Since the American Declaration of Independence came first, and the Latin American declarations came second, the one must have caused the others, right? But is there really a causal relationship between the two? There is a tendency among many people in the Anglo-American world to look at these Latin American independence movements as a consequence of the American Declaration of Independence. But is this a fair and accurate reading of history, or is it a simplistic and biased misreading of history? These are all questions about my very favorite topics, empires, revolutions, and freedom. And to make it spicier, we have these tricky questions about who tells history and how we tell history. What's the difference from telling this history from a Latin American perspective as opposed to an Anglo-American perspective? And here with me to unpack the history of Latin America, Mexico, and the American Declaration of Independence is a leading expert on Latin American history, Roberto Breña. Bienvenido, Roberto.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Breña is professor of history at the Center for International Studies at the College of Mexico in Mexico City, and he has published extensively on the Atlantic world, the history of liberalism, and revolutions in Latin America. So, Professor Breña, great to have you here. Let's get started by exploring that quotation that you just read from the Mexican Declaration of Independence from 1821. Why did you choose to start this episode on the American Declaration of Independence with that passage from the Mexican Declaration of Independence?
There are two Mexican declarations of independence. I will talk about that in a second. But the one I read, let's say, is the official one, the one who had consequences, not the first one. And I will explain it a little while. And I chose those passages. It was not that easy to find passages because the Mexican declaration is very brief. Very brief. This is a document that has no more than 25 lines. So I chose those in which the desire to become independent is more explicit. And one of the things I should clarify is that at that time, Mexico was an empire. Mexico became independent as El Imperio Mexicano, or the Mexican Empire. It is true that in the end, it was an empire that lasted less than a year. And after that, Mexico became a republic. And except for this second foreign effort to name a foreign emperor, let's say that last quarter of the 19th century, Mexico has been a republic throughout its entire history. So this was a parenthesis, and it was a very exceptional parenthesis. But it is important to mention that, because in what I read, the name empire appears. And that means that at that time, for only 9 months, almost 10 months, we were an empire.
Good. So just some follow-up questions. For me, it's very interesting because we did an episode on the Irish Declaration of Independence. And the first thing that struck me is actually the word 300 years, because in the Irish Declaration of Independence, they also use that exact number of years, 300 years. So why don't you just explain to the audience why the Supreme Junta chose 300 years for the period of time that they've been oppressed?
Yeah, and it was not the Supreme Junta in New Spain, what eventually became Mexico, that used the 300 years. This was a figure that was used throughout the whole of Spanish America. And the reason is very, very clear, very simple, is the fact that the Spanish Empire in Spanish America began at the beginning of the 16th century. So up until the beginning of the 19th century, that would have been almost millimetrically 300 years in the case of New Spain. So it was a figure that was used by the insurgents at first, those who rose against the Spanish Empire or the Spanish authorities in New Spain. And again, every time I say New Spain, I'm talking about Mexico, but Mexico began to exist in 1821. So if we're talking about the independence or emancipation process, we cannot talk of Mexico. It's like mentioning the name United States or using the name United States before 1783. Well, you talk about the 13 colonies.
Right. So let me just focus on New Spain now. So I've been referring to Mexico as Mexico. And indeed, in 1776, we would be referring to Mexico as New Spain.
Yep.
And did it roughly have the same boundaries that it has now?
Oh, no. No. The boundaries went to the north all the way to what I would say is more or less, let's say, the middle of the United States, talking from south to north. And in the western part of the United States, it would go even farther. It is important to remember that in the War of 1848-1846, Mexico lost more than half its territory to the United States. And this is exactly the territory I'm talking about.
Interesting. So to what extent are the citizens of New Spain in the 1700s considering themselves citizens of New Spain, or do they have more of an identity that's associated with being a Spanish colony?
Yeah, no, well, they were not citizens. They were subjects of the Spanish king. So, and that's a huge difference. The term citizen was not the term that it was used, because they considered themselves subjects, not citizens. No, citizens, and the whole concept of citizenship acquired with the age of revolutions, acquired an entity that has had since then, in the Western world at least, but that was not the case in the 18th century in many places.
Let me rephrase the question then, I'll do a comparison then, say, with like the Commonwealth of Virginia, right? By, you know, even the 1750s, we would say, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, there was a very strong local identity as being part of the colony of Virginia, right? To what extent are we having this strong local sense of identity within New Spain. So, you know, and a Virginia planter would say, I'm from Virginia. I'm not part of, you know, I'm not a Londoner or a British person per se. I'm a British subject technically, but my primary sense of identity is to the colony of Virginia.
Okay. Well, this is a very complicated and abstruse subject, identity, that you're talking about, Andrew. It's very difficult to say what would come first if you asked a new Spaniard at the end, at the, let's say, the middle of the 17th century, and then, let's say, at the middle of the, or the middle of the 16th century, or the middle of the 18th century, what would be their first response? I think that it would have varied. But in any case, New Spain, that is also an important issue. The fact that New Spain was the richest and most populated of the territories in which the Spanish Empire was divided. It was, let's say, the gem of the crown. And in that regard, let's say that identity in New Spain would have been, by the beginning of the 19th century, stronger than in other Spanish American territories. For example, El Virreinato de Rio de la Plata, what is today Argentina. Well, it began its existence in 1776. That is 40 years before the Spanish-American independence movements began. And if that's the case, well, that means that to have an identity as member of the viceroyalty of Rio de la Plata at the beginning of the 19th century was almost unthinkable. That was not the case with the viceroyalty of New Spain, because that viceroyalty had been in existence for almost 300 years. So that changes a lot from one Spanish-American territory to the other. But in any case, trying to answer your question, I would say that the viceroyalty of New Spain was very probably the one who had a more, let's say, a stronger identity, but we should be very careful with the word identity, because as you very well know, independence doesn't mean, in the cases of almost all of the countries we're talking about during the age of revolutions, independence doesn't mean that a nation already existed. The nations had to be built. The fact that the French used so much the term nation, or the concept nation, if you want, may be misleading in the sense that nations in Spanish America, or what would become Latin America in the second half of the 19th century, because before the second half, let's say the middle of the 19th century, the term Latin America was not used. But in any case, to start talking about identity, in the Mexican case, for example, a while ago I mentioned the war against the United States. One of the most important historical events that cements the Mexican identity would be the war with the United States. But we're talking here the middle of the 19th century, that is 30 years after we became independent. So nation was still a long way ahead.
All right. You mentioned a number of things there that I'd like to follow up on. You mentioned that New Spain was the jewel in the crown of the wider Spanish Empire.
Yeah.
So can you just quickly describe what the economy of New Spain was like at the time?
Well, the main commodity, Mexican silver, made from at least a century, made the Spanish Empire work. And I'm not exaggerating. In this regard, Carlos Marichal has very clearly shown that Mexican silver, let's say I'm talking about Mexican silver, it's the silver of New Spain, was crucial for the workings of the Spanish Empire for the whole 18th century.
And to what extent, speaking of the economy, are New Spanish traders or merchants dealing with the 13 American colonies or the British Sugar Islands at the time? Or are these kind of like separate trade networks? Do they interact ever?
The Caribbean is the melting pot, the commercial melting pot by, let's say, by definition. So, of course, traders from all of the three most important empires of that time, that is the British Empire, the French Empire, and the Spanish Empire. Of course, they made a lot of transaction in the Caribbean since way before the 18th century. No, it was, I think, the 18th century when things reached its peak, even the beginning of the 19th century. But of course, as you very well know, the 18th century is very much defined in military terms. No, and if that is the case, well, military issues affect very directly economical or commercial issues. But in any case, transactions went in all directions for sure.
So you would expect to see the major ports in the colonies, Philadelphia, Boston, and New York, trading with colonies in New Spain.
Yeah.
Pretty directly.
Yes, we should be very careful in this regard, because the Spanish Empire, up until 1778, and that is only 30 years before the independence movements began, was a very closed system. And the way we conceive commerce in the 21st century has nothing to do with the way in which commerce was conceived in the 18th century, though.
Why don't you just give me an example of a difference that's important?
Yeah, well, for the Spanish crown, only certain ports in Spanish America could make trade with only certain ports in the Spanish peninsula, let's say in the mother country. Right. That began to change in 1778. But up until that time, it was a very closed commercial system. And up until the very end, it's no coincidence that one of the most important demands in almost all the territories, especially those with ports, was the fact that they were tired of this very tight control that the Spanish crown had regarding commercial issues.
Okay, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of the major points we see, the major grievances against King George in the Declaration of Independence, is his restriction on trade.
Oh, yeah.
And this is what infuriates the planters in Virginia and the merchants in Boston and Philadelphia as much as anything else, that he's really, King George is really restricting the trade that they believe is their right to trade with whomever, basically whenever. And this does set off a lot of the grievances. And I just mentioned King George. There are different Spanish kings throughout the 18th century. How would you describe the relationship between the subjects of New Spain and their king? And a second question within that is, there were, like, you know, in the 13 colonies, there were colonists who were more on the kind of radical side of, we really want more independence and freedom. And then on the other side, there were very conservative loyalists who were like, we have full faith in King George and the monarchy. So is the political situation in New Spain kind of like that with the relationship with their kings?
No, I would say that in general terms, the subjects in Spanish America were very loyal. In fact, what was it that began the emancipation processes or independence processes, if you want, was the fact that Napoleon invaded Spain in 1808 and he took the King of Spain, Fernando VII, to French territory. And he was in a castle, but he was still a prisoner. In a castle, but still a prisoner. And what was the first reaction of all of the Spanish American territories, without any exception, was to consider Fernando VII their king, and therefore rejecting not only Napoleon, but Napoleon named his older brother Joseph King of Spain. And all of the Spanish territory rejected the new French king. And all of them supported Fernando VII as the only legitimate king of the Spanish Empire. And that event in particular, not the invasion in particular, but what transpired after the invasion, what was the historical event that triggered the emancipation processes. For the first couple of years, all of the Spanish-American territories remained loyal to Fernando VII. But then in 1811, some territories began to realize that this was a very good opportunity to separate from Spain. And the first declaration of independence was the declaration of Venezuela in July of 1811. But there are more than 3 years between the rise of the Spanish people in Madrid against the French troops, more than 3 years between that and the declaration of independence of Venezuela. So that's a long time. And for almost all of that period, the vast majority of Spanish Americans wanted to continue belonging to the Spanish Empire. That is, they wanted to continue being subjects of Fernando VII. So that's a huge difference with what happened in the 13 colonies.
Okay, so the sort of final, for me, just a basic difference between the British Anglo-North American colonies and the Spanish colonies, New Spain, and the others, is of course the British North American colonies are Protestant, except for Maryland, and all of the Spanish colonies are Catholic. So what are maybe some of the important points to remember about these differences?
Well, religion played a very important role in the Spanish-American independence movements. In fact, when you take a look at the two declarations of independence of New Spain or Mexico, if you want, you would realize the weight of religion in both declarations. And by the way, I will say just a few things about the first of the declarations that I said a while ago. I was going to say something and I didn't say, but I haven't said. So that, to begin with, religion was, in the Catholic religion, of course, I'm talking about, was very important for the Spanish Empire. And the role that the church played during the almost 300 years of Spanish dominance, or the dominance of the Spanish Empire in Spanish America, was fundamental in very, very many respects, not only politically, but also socially and in educational terms also. So this is an aspect that for someone coming from a Protestant country, maybe not that easy to understand, the role and the weight that religion played in Spain and consequentially in Spanish America.
Good. I'm going to come back to that later because I do want to explore another abstruse concept, which is how people thought of freedom in New Spain. But I started by talking about the fact that we can think of the American War of Independence as the precursor to Latin American independence movements, and that might not actually be accurate at all. And indeed, you've already mentioned some historical points that should give us pause here, that we shouldn't think of the American Declaration of Independence being too influential on Latin America. And you've already indicated that the invasion of Spain by Napoleon was much more important as a causal factor than anything else, despite the fact that they were still sort of had their allegiance to the king. Now, I think it's important that you just talk a little bit about this theory that the American Declaration of Independence was so important, so influential in Latin America, and maybe some reasons why you think that we should look at it from a different perspective.
Yeah. Well, I think this, in the last years, it has a book that David Armitage wrote in 2007, calling the Declaration of Independence a Global History. I think that it has had a lot of influence in order to consider the Spanish-American Declarations of Independence as using the word that Armitage uses a lot in his book, considering the American Declaration of Independence as a model. Well, I've read all of these declarations of independence of Spanish America, and I can tell you that a couple of them may have used, and I insist on may have used, because intellectual history has shown us, let's say at least intellectual history during the last 50 years has shown us that we have to be very careful with this notion of very much used at a certain moment in the history of ideas, notion of influence. No, we have to be very careful when we use the term influence. That was not the case 50 years ago. But now we should be careful. And I think that, again, I've read almost all of them, I think, of the Spanish-American Declarations of Independence. And in some of them, a few of them, I can see some influence. But I would say that in the majority of them, I don't see the presence of the American Declaration of Independence. And this has to do with this category that is so important for intellectual history nowadays, and that is the category of context. The context were so different regarding the Spanish-American independence movements vis-a-vis the context of the independence of the United States or the 13 colonies, that if the context is that different, I don't think that the fact that these declarations of independence are that different should surprise us. It only can surprise us if we sort of assume or accept propositions like the ones Armitage makes in his book. No, if we accept those assumptions regarding this omnipresence of the American Declaration of Independence, well, then it might strike us that these documents, many of these documents, it's very difficult to trace the influence of the Declaration, American Declaration of 1776. On the other hand, Andrew, it is also, if you want to find influences, you will find influence. So my point is that if you don't assume that, if you don't accept certain assumptions, like the assumptions made by the Armitage, you will not be surprised at all that they are not similar. And some, in fact, are very, very, very different from the Declaration of Independence of the United States. But again,
Well, history is about telling stories and having narratives. And I just want to maybe raise one or more assumptions that, say, an American citizen would have learned in school. And that would be that sort of the universal rights expressed in the first lines of the American Declaration, that all men are created equal, that they have the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Is this like shining light that the founding fathers of America lit, and then eventually that made its way through the rest of the world, starting in Venezuela in 1811, and then France before that, and went on. So like this concept of all men being created equal, that is not a driving force in the Latin American independence movements. You're saying that's a wrong assumption.
Well, two things. To begin with, natural rights was the most common of discourses in the 18th century. No, we're not talking here about human rights. That is a 20th century thing. We're talking here about natural rights. And that was part of the cultural and ideological ambiance of the Enlightenment. So there's nothing original in that. No, and in that regard, I would recommend, let's say, authors like Gary Wills or authors like Pauline Meyer. And they have studied the Declaration of Independence, and they have very clearly shown that it is not as original as, for example, an author like Armitage pretends. No?
Okay, let's explore another assumption. And now maybe I'm just talking about my own assumptions. I don't know if they're common amongst historians or Armitage.
Okay.
The concept of local control. So groups of people, local cultures, should not give away or have their control of their own affairs be conducted by some distant parliamentary body or distant king, local control, the independence of these communities, the right to make decisions for themselves, again, is that shining light that the American founders lit and spread its way through Latin America.
Well, that was an argument used in two or three of the Spanish-American documents. I mean, I'm talking about the geographical issue, the distance. The distance by itself, no, without any further argument, geography by itself tells us that we should be independent. That is true, but it's not very commonly used in the declarations of independence. I recall at least a couple of them that use that argument. No, we are so distant from Spain that we should become independent. But it's not common, that I can tell you. It's not common in the Spanish American independence, that argument. I've seen that argument in many papers and documents, but in declarations of independence, I think only two of them use that argument.
Let me rephrase it, not entirely from the geography perspective. It's more of the idea that local people should have control over their own lives. So local assemblies, this idea of taxation without representation. We shouldn't be taxed by, if we don't have any say in the taxation. And again, that only appears once in the Declaration of Independence. It's not this huge grievance that is repeated a lot. But again, I'm talking about sort of we're talking about intellectual history now, the dominant things that you would be taught as an American school child. Okay. Is this idea of local control of your own affairs?
I don't perceive that in Spanish American territories throughout the 18th century, and there's a reason for that. The way in which the British Empire works politically in America is very different from the way in which the workings of the Spanish American Empire. So the importance of assemblies and of local assemblies and the level of their capacity to take decisions or make decisions was far, far, far away from that being the case in Spanish America. That was not the case. It was a much more centralized empire. And it was an empire that did not expect subjects in each territory to make it or to take important decisions. No. And that, I think, explains a lot of things regarding the future of both the United States as an independent country and of the Latin American countries, or Spanish American countries, later Latin American countries. Because let's say that Spanish American territories had no experience at all with the Republican system and with representative institutions. It was a very limited experience in that regard. And that was not the case in the United States. So therefore the transition, let's say, was a smooth transition because you were used to that kind, and I say you because you are American, although you're in Germany now. But in any case, this is a very important element to explain the future of both countries, that the stability in one case and the instability in the other. We didn't have any experience at all with many of the institutions that were created with independence. And we paid a very high price for that.
Can you just elaborate on that a little bit more? Can you just explain what you mean a little bit more?
Yeah, because in Spanish American territories, and of course New Spain is included, or Mexico is included, we became republics with independence, except for this very brief. Brazil is a completely different case in this regard, and in many others, I would say. But in any case, in the case of Mexico, we only had this very brief parenthesis of an empire for 10 months. And after that, we became a republic, and since then, we've been a republic. And those institutions, Republican institutions, if you want those institutions to work, representative institutions in general, and a representative, let's say, political culture has to exist in order for that system to work. Well, that did not exist in the Spanish-American territories. And therefore, of course, if from one day to the other you adopt a system that presupposes a series of aspects that you don't have any experience, almost any experience with them, well, you will pay the price. And in politically speaking, I mean, and we did pay the price. Just look at the political instability in the region for at least the first half of the 19th century, but in many countries during the whole 19th century.
Okay, let me ask you a slightly more complicated question then. So again, I accept the point that a lot of the assumptions that Anglo-Americans make about the influence of the Declaration of Independence requires more context, as you said. Some of these ideals we see in the American Declaration don't map to Latin America well at all. But now you just mentioned something that I thought does. So when they do declare independence, they choose a model to adopt, and it is a representative democratic model. Could you not argue that came from the United States?
Oh, yeah. No, in that sense, of course, there's an influence of the American political system in the drafting of many constitutions in the Spanish-American territories or Latin-American territories. But the chronological precedence explains that, I think. The thing is, chronological precedence by itself does not mean or should not mean a causal relationship, cause and effect. I think we should be very careful in that regard. I've seen that a lot in some of the experts on the Atlantic revolutions. Just because of a certain chronological precedence, they try to establish a series of causal connections that, in my view, they just don't work very well. Not even between the Spanish independence of the 13 colonies and the French Revolution. Less so with the Haitian independence movement, or revolution, I would say. It would be better to say revolution, because the Haitian independence movement Haitian revolution was not an independence movement, but until the very end of it. And more so regarding the Spanish-American independence movements. I think we should be very cautious regarding those sequences that certain authors, mostly Anglophone authors, establish between, there's only one revolution that goes from Philadelphia to Paris, from Paris to Saint-Domingue, and from Saint-Domingue to all the capitals in Spanish America. I think we should be very, very careful with that kind of sequences.
Good, I agree with that. So let's go back to New Spain and just think a little bit more about New Spain.
Okay, yes. One thing I had to mention since the beginning of our conversation, Andrew, was the fact that the 1821 Declaration of Independence was not the only Declaration of Independence in New Spain. There was a precedent 8 years before 1821, that is in 1813, and that was the Declaration of Independence made by the insurgents that were fighting against the Spanish authorities in New Spain. No. Insurgents that, of course, the Spanish crown and the Spanish authorities in New Spain termed or defined as rebels. No. And that has some connections with the case in the 13 colonies, because when they drafted that Declaration of Independence, that it's never called a declaration, by the way, but in any case, they did not want to be considered rebels. And they gave many reasons, 27 in particular, why George III has gone against, let's say, the kind of historic relationship that or compact that they had established since the very beginning. And those 27 elements explained by themselves, you're a tyrant. If you're a tyrant, we're not rebels, and therefore we want to be independent. In that regard, there are some, of course, let me be clear about this. I'm not saying that there are no possible connections regarding certain issues between the American Declarations of Independence and some of the Spanish-American Declarations of Independence. In general terms, I am very skeptical about this, assuming this position that there was a very important presence and that there was an influence, and even less, of course, I would talk about causality.
So how did the insurgents in Mexico, what kind of people are they? Are these like wealthy people like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, who have all this land and all this political power already? Or, you know, who are these insurgents in New Mexico?
Well, the Mexican insurgency is a very peculiar insurgency because it was the only insurgency in the whole of Spanish America that was directed by priests. At first, Miguel Hidalgo, and then José María Morelos. And that very much defined the Mexican insurgency up until the very end. That to begin with, if two priests in this case are the ones who are directing and controlling up to a certain point the insurgency in this case in New Spain, that will very much define the whole movement in political, ideological, and social terms. And because these were priests that were very orthodox in religious terms. We're not talking here about, I think the word in English is defrocked, right? Mm-hmm. Or something like that. Priests. That was not the case at all with Miguel Hidalgo and with José María Morelos. They were very traditional priests. No. In fact, the only insurgency in the whole Spanish America that was against the decision taken by the Cortes of Cádiz in Spain regarding the abolition of the Inquisition was a Mexican insurgency. That gives you an idea of how traditional the Mexican insurgency was. But in any case, what is important at this point is, for me, is to be very clear in the sense that we do not have only one Declaration of Independence. And that was the one I read at the beginning of this conversation. There's another one. It precedes it in 8 years. It was declared by the Mexican insurgents. The thing is that they declared this independence at the end of 1813, precisely at the moment when they were beginning to lose power, to lose the military presence and power that they had since the beginning of the rebellion in 1810 up until the end of 1813. But it's sort of not, I don't know, it's paradoxical, but it's curious at least that exactly at the moment that they declare independence, they were beginning to lose clout, let's say. And in 1814, Morelos is captured, and in 1815, he is executed. Yeah, he's executed, as Hidalgo was executed in 1811. So by 1815, the Mexican insurgency is a very weakened insurgency. And one of the main persons responsible for that weakness is a military from the Spanish Royal Army, and that is Agustín de Iturbide. He was the person who in 1820 changes sides and decides that New Spain should be independent. But he fought against the Mexican insurgents for many years. That is one of the aspects that people that are not acquainted with the Mexican independence process may find difficult to understand. And it's a very complex situation. The person who consummated independence in 1821 was one of the most important militaries who went against the Mexican insurgents since the beginning of the rebellion up until 1820.
I was thinking, well, of course, people are people. They change their minds as things change. And I'm thinking specifically now of another example from the American Revolution, and that's Benedict Arnold, who went from being a rebel to being a loyalist, so a traitor in the other respects. But I think when you look at the history of the 13 colonies, you see people going on a journey of realizing, okay, you know, maybe I'm inching closer and closer to this idea of independence. And it doesn't all happen at once. Individuals are changing their minds over the course of years until there are enough of them who all agree with the same thing. I mean, it's very much a political, long-term political process. So I guess my question for you is, You've mentioned the two different Mexican declarations of independence. We have a lot going on. As an intellectual historian, do you see an inevitable movement from a certain point of time that indicates that, yes, Mexico will one day be free?
Well, I would begin by saying that there's nothing inevitable in history. That to begin with. As in life, as in the person of life of each one of us, there's nothing inevitable. This is a very, very famous dictum that the only thing that it's inevitable are two things, taxes and death. That to begin with. But but my point is that the case of Iturbide is peculiar because he was one of the most successful Spanish military against the insurgents. It was in 1820 when the liberals came back to power in Spain. And of course, the Cortes of Madrid, or Congress, if you want, in Madrid, started making some decision and taking some legal actions regarding the military and the church and landowners, that Iturbide changed sides. He was very sympathetic. He was a military. He was very sympathetic to the church and religion in general, and he was a landowner. So he was going to be affected evidently by the measures that were being decided in the liberal Cortes of Madrid. And that's another point that I haven't mentioned because it hasn't come about. But the truth is that the arrival of liberalism in Spain in 1810, the Spanish liberal constitution of 1812, the Cortes de Cádiz, the gathering of the Cortes de Cádiz from 1810 to 1812, and the Cádiz constitution of 1812 was very important in several Spanish American territories for the way things happened and how they happened and when they happened. That was not the case in all of the territories. Not all of the Spanish American territories followed the Cádiz Constitution, but several of them, among them the two most important viceroyalties, that is New Spain and Peru, decided to go along with the Cortes of Cádiz because they wanted to continue being a part of the Spanish Empire. No, that's something that Spanish American historiographies or Latin American historiographies do not mention very often. But the truth is that a lot of Spanish Americans wanted to continue being part of the Spanish Empire.
Interesting.
The wars of independence or of emancipation in Spanish America are mainly civil wars. And they're civil wars for a very simple reason. Because the percentage of peninsular Spaniards in the Spanish American territory was very, very, very limited. So they had to be civil wars. And that to begin with. We're not talking here of liberation wars. We're talking about civil wars. But in the case of New Spain, for example, if it began in 1810, it went all the way up until 1821 to become independent. With that very few amount of troops, Spanish troops, and of Spanish or peninsular inhabitants, in principle, it would have been very easy for New Spain to become independent. One of the reasons why that didn't happen, and Peru is exactly the same thing, was a very simple, in my view, a very simple conclusion. And that is that many New Spaniards and many Peruvians did not want to become independent. But that, of course, I mean, you can imagine that for Latin American historiographies, that doesn't sound very well. But for me, after studying these processes for more than a quarter of a century, that is, for me, it's a very clear or evident conclusion. One of the many conclusions you can arrive at.
Well, as you were saying that, I was thinking immediately about a new trend maybe in studies of the American Revolution that is really considering it also a civil war. It was not a war of independence as much as we should be considering it the first American Civil War. And I just want to mention this because it goes back to what you were saying. There is no influence factor on the specific dynamics of the British 13 colonies. It was just simply that some of the people in the British American colonies wanted to be independent and some didn't. and hence you have deep conflicts that lead to civil war. And that's exactly how you were describing, say, Peru. But they have nothing to do with each other, except that this characteristic happens to be present in both. And I think that's one of the big takeaways that I'm getting from this conversation today.
And not only many inhabitants, let's say common people, wanted to continue to be part of the Spanish Empire. You see that with many of the most important leaders during the Age of Revolutions, that up until the very end, they tried to still be a part of the empire, but at some point, they finally decide that they want to become independent. I've been very critical of this perspective regarding Hidalgo and Morelos, in the sense that since the very first day, that is the 16th of September of 1810, they knew exactly what they wanted and that they wanted to become independent. In my view, that is not the case. Regarding Hidalgo, I think up until the very end, he was very clear in this regard. Morelos was clear, but he was clear from, let's say, the end of 1812, the beginning of 1813. That's when he very clearly decides for independence. But since the very beginning of the rebellion, that is September 1810, up until the end of 1812, beginning of 1813, things were not that clear. And it's very normal. Because, I mean, what is a revolution if not the absolute, it's the world turned upside down, in this very famous phrase by Christopher Hill regarding the English Revolution. Well, if things turn upside down, it's very, very difficult, to have things perfectly clear in the sense that you know exactly where you're heading in political terms. I think there are very few examples in history that have this clarity since the very beginning. I think, for example, Lenin, in the case of the Russian Revolution, would be one of those exceptions. Since the very beginning, he had very clear what he wanted. No? And the 1905 Revolution was very useful in that regard, by the way. He knew those errors that shouldn't be made again in 1917. But Lenin is exceptional in many senses. No? And in the case of the Haitian Revolution, Toussaint Louverture, up until the very end, and you see that in his last letters when he was a prisoner in France, he did not want to separate from France. No? So it's not an, Hidalgo and Morelos are no exception except if you assume that revolutionaries have things very clear in their head since the very beginning, but that's not the case almost never, I would say.
Fascinating. Roberto, thank you so much. You've really clarified to me that sometimes from an Anglo-American perspective, we do overemphasize the primacy, the central importance of the American Declaration of Independence in the history of the Western Hemisphere and also the history of the world. And I think maybe for me, one of the lessons that I'm taking from this episode, as we think about the 250-year anniversary of the American Declaration of Independence, is to be a little bit humble in how important it is. So that's my takeaway. But Roberto, I ask all my guests for them to reflect on the Declaration of Independence 250 years in the future. So for you, what are the big takeaways as we think about this anniversary?
Andrew, regarding your last question, I think that chronological precedence by itself, and the fact that the United States became such an important country in the history of the world, would be enough for me to give the Declaration of Independence a very important place in the political, ideological, and intellectual history of the world. At the beginning, mainly the Western world, but in the end, the whole world. That being said, I also think that humbleness and skepticism should also play a role. I think we at the same time can accept the importance and the transcendence of the Declaration of Independence, and at the same time be humble and skeptical regarding its purported influence, because I think, as the Spanish-American Declarations of Independence show, there was a presence in some cases, but there was an, I wouldn't say an absence, but let's say that there did not consider, in some cases at all, the American Declaration of Independence in their declarations of independence. So I think we should be just careful and cautious, let's say humble and skeptical, regarding the position that certain Anglophone historians have adopted.
Roberto Breña, thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.